listening to the Mouthful of Graffiti podcast, affectionately known as The Mog, an open forum and promotional outlet for budding artists and creatives from all across the Mid-Atlantic region. I'm your host, Brad Cox, not necessarily affectionately known as anything other than Brad Cox, but I'm here all the same. Let's see who and what we're chewing on today on The Mog. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls of all ages, welcome to The Mog. As always, links for our guests will be made available in the description, and a song or some type of promotional feature will be tacked on to the end of each episode. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Roswell incident of 1947, but not only do some suspect that alien technology was recovered at the crash site, but also a recipe book for all the great food being served at Vagabond Sandwich Company, right here in Bel Air, Maryland. Because as we all know, the food is out of this world. Remember, love local, support local, and eat and drink local. And I'd love to give a shout out to all the local sponsors, Musicland, Reb Records, and Capricose Books. Use discount code MOGPOD, M-O-G-P-O-D, for a 10% discount at Capricose Books. Welcome to the first episode of Turning the Tables. Today I'm sitting down with drummer and dad joke enthusiast, Mr. Gary Holmes. Gary is best known for slamming the skins for Schizo Calypso, and We Love the Underground, but he's also the father of three, and after 19 years, I can assure you he's a loyal friend. On this podcast, I'm going to interview Gary, but after the break, it'll be his chance to turn the tables and try and stump me here on The Mog. Welcome to the show, Gary. How you doing today?
Brad, I'm doing well, my friend. It's good to be here, man.
Yeah, it's great to have you. Now, we've known each other for a very long time.
An incredibly long time, man. Would you say 19 years? I felt like it was longer, but that's probably right.
Yeah, it's about 19 years. I think in EPs or albums, it's about like a healthy dozen.
It's like a dog years. I mean, yeah. It kind of exponentially compounds itself the longer and more albums we produce, right?
Right, right. So for our listeners and in your own words, how did we meet?
We met, I remember specifically where. It was at Howl Daddy's.
Okay.
And a lot of local people will remember that club. I don't think it exists anymore, but it was a very small venue. People played in the basement through a mutual friend. We were both there seeing a band at you know, I was at the time in between bands, and I think you were looking for a drummer, so just kind of happened. That was it.
That mutual friend actually got very sick that night.
That mutual friend did get sick.
Yeah.
It was a rough night for him. I'm glad he did. If he hadn't gotten sick, I don't know that we would be here right now.
Yeah, and we won't name him, but prior to Schizo Calypso, you actually were in a couple of different bands. You were with Scott Lester's Fall Town.
I was.
And you were in Fovea with Dave Erickson. What was the, I mean, this is, Schizo Calypso was such a departure musically from, I mean, those bands were kind of like on the softer side of alternative, more like Gin Blossoms. And what was the allure to join in a band like Schizo Calypso?
I honestly think that it was, first off, was it just a great opportunity. And for me, I really wanted to get out and just try something different.
Mm-hmm.
And we both mutually knew Greg Gatto.
Yeah.
He was a good guy. I've known Greg since high school. And, you know, I think it was a tryout. You came over. We threw it together. And it was there's just an incredible energy there when we started playing. I think the aftertaste may have been one of the first songs we did.
Yeah.
Which is a very, very, as you said, it's a huge departure for someone like me who had been playing more in that Matchbox 20 style of rock and roll.
Yeah.
So really finding that energy and just, it was exciting. So for me, it was cool to stick with it and really learn a new part of music for myself and a new style of drumming that I hadn't had a chance to explore in previous projects.
And I know this about you. Your biggest influences from the formative years would be like Metallica, I guess maybe 311, which is two really juxtaposed bands stylistically. And I kind of feel like Schizo Calypso in some weird way is the amalgamation of those two styles.
You know, yeah, I never thought of that.
Yeah.
But it was. For me, Schizo was very, it was like heavy metal meets punk rock.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's the Calypso vibe, right? Which has got that kind of like some beachy sort of like Latin elements to it. But I grew up listening to Metallica like a lot of guys my age. Obviously, Lars is a great drummer. But I think it was sort of the same allure almost. You know, yeah. Metallica was sort of the band for me that, you know, you heard this like incredible guitars and vocals that just sort of grabbed you by the throat when you're a young kid. And I was young at the time when the Black Album came out. And it was sort of that same vibe when I was in the basement that day. It sort of felt a little chaotic, a little out of the element. Yeah, and I think that's kind of what really sucks you into something different. And it just resonated.
Yeah, now, there was a certain mythos that kind of formed around the band before I even really took the band out live. And your brother was aware of that. Were you aware of that too?
A little bit. So
I became aware of it through other people. It was weird.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because I actually have an image in my mind, and everybody knows, or a lot of people do, the famous face image of Schizo Calypso that you have tattooed on your arm and everything else. So when I was with Fovea and even Fall Town, we did recording with Dave Pace.
Okay.
And a lot of people in Bel Air did.
Right.
And I remember, you know, being in that studio and seeing the images up on the wall and just reading some of the song titles, and because I think it was maybe the Join the Cult album cover was up there. So that was what I remember. And then when I met you, it kind of came full circle in the sense that I think it was just about as chaotic and and what I sort of would have expected, but yeah, it lived up to the mythology.
Yeah,
if there was some.
Your parents were absolute saints during that.
Yes.
I mean, it was loud, it was mean, there was like, obviously a lot of language, and the shows were aggressive. You know, the people that were coming, it was almost, looking back at some of the old videos, violent, like with the mosh pits and all that. And
yeah, I mean, shout out to my parents because they did. They put up with a tremendous amount of noise and just really insane stuff for a long time down in that basement. And I'll never forget that. Was it Paloma's was the first show?
Yeah.
We played in that room with the mirrors, and it was just packed to the gill with... And the thing I loved about it, and this is really, I think, what spoke to me the most, is the people that were at the show were people that loved music.
Yeah.
These were people that were really into rock and roll, people that really had a passion for the style of music we were doing. And, you know, we had fans in the other bands, but, you know, you sort of... It was a little more vanilla in the sense that it was a lot of family and friends that came out, and some people liked the music. But for me, looking out into a sea of people that I really didn't know, except for maybe the few that came out to see me that first night, it was exciting to be able to go, wow, this is something special where people are going to be into the music and I think into what we're going to do long term.
Yeah, there was it was all the rockers and the punkers, and it was the scene. And I don't know if you had been a part of that prior, but it was its own animal, really.
Yeah, and it was the beginning of an animal too. It's so funny because we did it for so long, and when you reflect on all of those years, I wish I knew what it was going to be like for the next 5-10 years after that, and how much the music scene in Baltimore would just explode.
Yeah.
It was a great time to be getting into that. And, but you're right. It was something new and a lot of great hardcore people.
Yeah. So I've known you for a very long time. What was your musical background prior to Fall Town of Fovea?
So I started playing the drums in late elementary school, early middle school, really taking it seriously. I never did band or anything like that. I had friends who did some of that, but I was, for the most part, pretty self-taught until I started taking private lessons, and I did private lessons for a lot of years, but for me, it was always about trying to get into a rock band. That's what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
That's what resonated with me.
What was the drummer's name at Musicland?
Will DiGiorgio.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a great guy, and he taught me so much. And really pushed me into learning different elements. I mean, I never became a jazz drummer or any of those things, but I was exposed to a lot of that and tried the best that I could for my ability to incorporate it into what I do.
Did you have any bands in high school, or were you in the band, chorus, anything like that?
No, was never in any sort of school band or marching band or anything like that. It was always rock bands. And even before Fall Town, I think at the 10th grade, I was in a band called Shades of Gray. It never really did much, but it
See,
was
I didn't know that.
It was three of us, and it was my first exposure to playing with other musicians, and it's really what kick-started the excitement to get into and doing bands.
Yeah, so what were some of your earlier shows?
So I think the first show that I ever really played, outside of, we did high school talent shows, we did coffee houses, things of that nature, but my first real show that I would say in Baltimore was at the Brass Monkey. Fovea did that, and it was really, that was an exciting night. I remember specifically I went out to a thrift store to try to buy what I thought would be a cool shirt.
Right.
It wound up being this like blue and black, like velvet. It's ridiculous. I have to find a picture of it.
Oh, I need to see this.
Yeah. It's, you don't want to wear velvet on stage. It's no. Not a good look, especially if you're drumming.
Right. So we got to play a lot of shows together and live out a lot of our dreams, kind of on a smaller scale. I remember at one of your earlier parties, your brother came up to me, and of course we're all drinking, but he was genuine when he said, he's like, I really feel like this band is going to do something. Now, this is like literally a month or two into meeting you guys. And I'm like, yeah. But we really did do something. What are some of the shows that you're most proud of?
It's a good question. And I mean, there's a lot of them. For me, I think some of the shows where we got to open for some big national acts, we were fortunate enough to be able to open for Skid Row several times. The Brides of Destruction show for me has to be one that sticks out in my mind. And for anybody who doesn't know what that is, that was a project that Nikki Six from Motley Crue was doing at the time. Mm-hmm. And it was a side project, but man, that was just awesome to be a part of that and to experience the whole sort of aura around that, from their fans to the tour buses and the whole nine yards. But those were always exciting because it felt like you were taking that next step. So
yeah. So how about favorite songs? Like before we started writing music together, were there certain standout tracks for you?
Yeah, I mean, it was very interesting joining the band and not being familiar with the catalog. And there was such a rich catalog. And I think for me, it was some of the stranger songs, like Oh Mr. Daniels was a good one, right? Like there was some songs that were just very... very unique in the way they sounded, in the way that you blended stuff together. A lot of stuff off Join the Cult. I think Join the Cult itself is a great one.
Yeah.
Or, I'm sorry, no, Shooting Down.
Yeah, it's
Shooting
Join
Down.
The Cult.
Yeah, sorry.
You're right.
But yeah, those, I mean, Black Fly obviously is a great one. That was one that I had to learn. And then The Aftertaste was probably the signature song, in my opinion, before we really started writing music and kind of evolving into more of a full band sound that incorporated the other elements that we were bringing to the table.
How about songs that we wrote together? What are some of the standout tracks?
It's funny because I had a feeling you were going to ask me this, and I've really been thinking a lot about it.
Well, I'm curious if it's the same as it would be for me.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the Shattering itself was an interesting one. The actual song, The Shattering.
Yeah. I remember trying to record that with you. You know, back in that time, you were basically recording without a click track, live rhythm, live drums, and the song had all these different changes, and we got through it almost convincingly.
And I think there is, not that I would ever recommend anyone going into a studio and not recording to a click track
right.
in 2021, but back then, before we knew any better and before we even cared, there was a level of raw energy and just power.
It was.
That came with that when you weren't worried about all of the other studio stuff. And we learned to get better at that. But I think that, to me, was one of the standout power songs.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I think further down the line, when we wrote and recorded Until My Heart Stops Beating was one I feel like that really was an evolution of songwriting and our approach to recording. I actually think, and I could be wrong about this, but that was our first... It was a shared project between John and Tony, right? And an introduction into Tony's world and mixing and certain things. And I just feel like that song really, that was one that I was really proud to not only play for the fans of the band, but people that I thought would also be getting into the band after that.
It was probably the most accessible. Like a song like The Aftertaste is not going to appeal to a lot of people. But Until My Heart Stops Beating, while still heavy, it still has that crossover appeal.
Yeah.
So.
And I loved the evolution of all that, just going from being a band that was so heavy and so, I would not want to say one-dimensional at all, but we were focused on being loud, being aggressive, putting on that live stage show, to really getting into more dynamic style of writing, more dynamic style of how it was going to impact, you know, the overall song and message.
And at times that kind of became a rub, because you and I had kind of different visions, different approaches. You know, you're more of a planner.
And absolutely.
And I'm more of just like, let's just do it. And I think, though, having the two dynamics in the band is why it worked for so long, because you kind of need both.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and I think about it all the time. And when I do my portion, These are some of the things that I want to not only talk about, but as I reflect back on that, I completely agree. Like, I'm the kind of person that wants it to be, like, I want to be sure, right? And I think if I had have been leading the charge, we'd still be on our first album, because I wouldn't be ready yet to record it or finish the songs. And you, man, were just always gangbusters. Let's get in there. Let's record it. Let's make this happen. And it's funny, because looking back, I appreciate that so much more now than I did then, and how we have time stamped so much of our life into music.
Yeah.
And that's a really cool thing to have. And I don't know that a lot of people that are just at the local level can really look back in the last 20 years and say, that song was written at this point in my life when I was doing this thing and thinking about that thing. And for you, it's got to be even more powerful, because they're your words, they're your thoughts, they're your emotions, right?
Yeah, it's weird.
So
sometimes it's weird to go back and listen to a song, because I'm not as full of piss and vinegar as I used to be, you know. But I'm glad that I did it, and I'm glad that I said it, because like you said, it's kind of like this timeline that just keeps growing, and I can actually see like a diary.
Yeah. And it's good that you had all that to begin with, that fire and just that sort of saying whatever was on the top of your mind. And just, I love that.
I'm not even sure I could get away with that still.
No, I mean, but again, that was a time and place,
right?
You know, that was when you should have done those things and you did them. And it spoke to a lot of people that way. And I think a lot of people, you know, admire that, to be able to just sort of just let it rip. Because it's not an easy thing to do, and it's coming out of your mouth, and it's your idea, and, you know, it hits people right between the eyes.
So I know that you're more of a fact over faith type of an individual.
Right.
And what I mean by that is, if, you know, something almost otherworldly takes place, you're not going to look outside of the physical space for answers. You're going to try to find a logical, rational reason why something happened.
Right.
But 2 years into knowing you, we came to the realization, and I brought the picture down here to show you, and we'll describe to the listener what that is, but that our families had a connection that actually dated back prior to us, almost, if not prior to us.
Oh, yeah, very, very much so. And it was a really, really weird thing when we learned that.
Yeah.
You know, there was definitely a synchronicity, like an energy, just kind of like, it was even
clicked.
More so meant to be than we thought.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, I'll dive into the story, you know.
Yeah.
My grandfather.
I'm going to go ahead and pop the picture up here so the listener can get an idea as you describe it.
So this picture that we're looking at is two grandparents, two older guys, one which is Brad's grandfather. And then we believe the other one is my grandfather, because we found out they lived in the same neighborhood, and that my father and your mother actually knew each other as children and actually spent time together at one another's homes.
Your father's brother dated my mother.
I know.
I mean, and for two guys that met in a How Daddy's basement, who had no idea they were going there that night, you know, and then to forge a band relationship coming from completely different worlds is kind of otherworldly.
It is very much so. And I think one of the cool things that kind of comes out of that is when my parents found out about that. Because you guys were at my parents' house all the time. That's where we practiced. And the connection, when my dad realized, like, wow, this is the grandson of my father and mother's close friend, and I know these people really well. And there was just that whole connection. And like you said, we've been friends for such a long time, but that's when it really started to feel even more like a family to me. Not only the band, but the relationship that we all had.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I believe that your mother found a picture of your father at my mother's wedding.
It's very possible.
I have it upstairs. It blew my mind.
Yeah.
You know, for one, I had never seen pictures of my mother that age, but to have her standing next to your father.
You know what? I do remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll have to check that picture out because that, yeah, it is mind-blowing, man.
So, that said, how do you explain that? That is not, that to me, it doesn't come from chance.
I don't think it does. I mean, I definitely think that in the world, whatever religion you believe in or whatever it is, and I know that, you know, you had a very religious upbringing. I was brought up in religion as well, but I definitely think there's meaning in the universe. There's got to be.
Yeah.
And I think that it really injected itself into what we do.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the power of the music that came to follow.
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely a fuel.
Yeah, for sure.
And I felt like at that time in my life that your parents were kind of like indirectly like carrying the torch for my parents. I'd kind of like alienated my parents at that point in my life. And they swooped in. They were never judgmental. I'm up on stage, like, giving people the finger, F this, F that, whatever. And your parents just sat there, arms crossed, drinking a beer. And that's cool. Let him get it out of his system, whatever. So I really appreciate your parents. And I just think that the connection there is just wild.
Yeah, and I mean, I know they feel the same way about you and what you brought to the table. I mean, it really was exciting. And I think the thing about my parents and that I love about them, and ever since I was a little kid, they really never tried to censor anything that I looked at or watched or did.
Yeah, because you're a horror fan.
Yeah, and I have been since I was probably well too young to become a horror fan. I think I had pictures of Freddy Krueger hanging on the wall when most kids had, you know, Teletubbies or whatever else.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, but they knew that, like, this, there was more to it than that. It was all part of the show.
Yeah.
And they were able to understand that and keep us grounded, keep me grounded as a human. And I've always been grounded. So I don't think there was ever a thought that it was going to be some kind of an actual cult.
Right.
Because you're like, what band are you in? We're called, I just joined a cult, literally.
Join the cult is, well, we could get into that another time. But anyway, one thing that a lot of people don't know about you outside of the rock and roll lifestyle and the bands is that you love comedy. You wanted to be a comedian.
I've always aspired to do that.
What's stopping you?
You know, I don't know.
Because people tell you that you're funny.
They do.
And you know that you're funny.
I'm not sure. I think sometimes I'm funny. If there was a way to take 2-second anecdotes on Facebook and make it into a comedy, maybe I would. Someday I think I would like to try it. I've toyed around with writing a routine. But for me, my comedy, I feel like is spontaneous.
Yeah.
Like it's more in the moment. Maybe someday I will, Brad. Maybe you'll inspire me. I started an Instagram page that I've done nothing with.
Is there an open mic type situation for comedians?
There probably is. I'm sure that there is. I know nothing about the local comedy scene, but I do listen to... I'm a big fan of comedy, obviously.
Yeah.
And the one thing about comedy, much like, and maybe even more so than original music, is it's very cutthroat. I mean, you have to really be a part of the scene. You really have to put yourself out there. You got to get in the trenches.
Yeah.
And for me, I think that's probably the only thing that scares me right now is that you going back into those trenches at this point in my life and being able to actually dig out to a point where it might be meaningful. So
it seems like it would be overwhelming to learn all the material. Like, you know, here, if we want, we've got papers in front of us and we can kind of like, oh, well, I want to ask this.
Yeah.
But with comedy, you're up there, there's nothing to look at. You've got to have it all ready and you got to have your delivery ready.
So, oh, yeah. I mean, and that's part of it. It's pacing. I mean, and that's, you see guys like Dave Chappelle, I mean, that's what they're so good at.
Yes.
It's just, it's building that anticipation around that final joke, that final right. punchline that's just going to knock everybody out of the room. And that takes a lot of practice. I mean, I think you can be funny, but to get up on stage and do a routine like that, you need to have that time and you got to have that commitment to get to fine tune your craft to a point where people actually want to hear it.
I think comedy could be your voice. I realized kind of as time went on that what I was really good at above some of the things that maybe I'm known for is writing.
Yep.
Whether it's writing songs or it's books or doing a podcast where you're kind of like doing all that prep and kind of coming up with like a flow for how the show is going to go.
Yeah.
I'm good at that. And your voice seems to be like it could be comedy. And, you know, you had an opportunity in Schizo Calypso to actually share your voice.
I did.
And I think that, as people could probably hear on the show, your voice is naturally raspy. So you kind of naturally fell into doing backing vocals. There's like real deep guttural screams. Where is the rasp coming from?
It's crazy because I don't really know. It's almost like it's just there. And I can easily do that. But if you ask me to hold a note, any note in key, it is like I have to work tirelessly to try to do that. And I don't know whether, I mean, they always say, and one of the things you have always said is that you can find your voice, you could learn how to sing. And I feel like I've really tried over the years to understand what that's like, but I just don't know how to do it. Yeah. But if you would tell me to get up there and sing a Pantera song, I'm okay to do that. And I can belt that out without even thinking about it.
I think over time, I've actually heard you get a little bit better. And part of it's being able to hear the pitches.
Right.
You know, and you've always been able to do that. It's just getting your mouth to kind of cooperate with your brain to do it.
Yeah, and understanding head voice and all the other.
Right.
It's an instrument.
It's breathing and support and all that stuff. So after about 14 years with Schizo Calypso, you were given like a second bite at the apple with We Love the Underground.
Yep.
And that was a really cool run for us. It was like we got to take everything that we had learned in Schizo, hundreds of shows, and repurpose it for We Love the Underground. What was it like kind of going back out there after all those years of doing Schizo Calypso?
It was great, man. I mean, it was a fresh start, working with new people. And it was very interesting because you started We Love the Underground as a solo project, in which I was privileged enough to play on and get to do a lot of the songs on drums. So it was a little strange at first because, you know, these other guys, Pat, Eric, all the guys that you were bringing in,
yeah,
they had learned all this material.
Yeah.
They had like learned it verbatim. And
we never had that in Schizo.
No, we were like, yeah, just go out and play it if it's close enough, right?
Yeah.
You know,
it's close
enough. Doesn't have to
hit
the bullseye. So I remember the first couple practices. I mean, here I am. I recorded these songs.
Yeah.
And I don't know what I'm doing. Like, I don't even remember recording some of these things. And I'm thinking to myself, I don't even know. Did I play that? Did Tony edit that? What was that? And meanwhile, Pat and Eric, these two guys coming from a classical background and having this incredible talent,
right,
are looking at me and I'm going, oh my God, I'm going to have to step my game up. And I think for me, above and beyond going back out and having a new invigoration of playing in a band again, playing with those two guys really elevated my musical prowess.
Yeah.
Because I was never one to really.
It was
be
almost
a technical
stressful
guy.
At times.
It was,
yeah.
You know, but it was a good thing because we became very, very polished.
Yeah.
And you had to be on your game playing in that band. And it pushed me to another level, which at that point in my life was what I needed.
Yeah. Well, schedules being what they are, and time being kind of a vacant premise in middle adulthood, do you think you'll ever be in a band like Schizo Calypso or We Love the Underground again?
I think I will definitely be in a band again. Whether I can be in a band that strikes at that point when it's right, will be hard to see.
Yeah.
But I will get out and play again. And it was interesting because the break that I've taken has given me the opportunity to really reflect on what I want to do and where I want to go. You know, obviously I have young children, so it's been nice to be able to spend that time and not be focused on the next show, the next recording, all those kinds of things. But I do see something in the future. I just don't know what it is yet. But I'll be ready for it when it comes.
I'll tell you, one of the things that happened after Underground kind of dissolved was that I felt all those years of shows and promoting and all that, I was exhausted finally. It finally hit me. And really for like 2.5 years, I didn't do much as maybe people think I was doing. I was writing books and stuff, but that was more like leisurely. That was something I was doing for fun. Did you feel tired, like when things started to finally slow down? If I slow down, I'll stop. Did you feel like that like wake of the whole thing that you had done?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I felt for the first time in my life that there was not a sense of where did I need to be and when was I going to be there and when was the next ticket that I was going to sell and all
right.
those kinds of things. And it was really important because, you know, even though I was not in a band that was gone for months at a time or, you know, overseas, those kinds of things, being in a band for that long and that consistency, it takes a lot out of you and the people you're around.
Yeah.
Because so much of it revolves around that. And to not have to do that for a period of time, I think was very, has allowed me to recharge.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to end this show with a track that you wrote for Schizo Calypso because you didn't have anything to really promote today. It's a song called The Haunted Save Your Life. Tell me a little bit about that song.
So that song we did, I think it was in probably around 2007. And it was around that time I could play guitar barely. And I'd always had the itch to be able to put something together. And I had asked you, I said, do you have any lyrics or anything laying around that I could have and play around with? And you did. You graciously gave me that set of lyrics. And I tried to do my best to put a melody to it. I'm a vocal melody, and then wrote a very rudimentary guitar part and tried to put together. So yeah, that's probably my biggest songwriting contribution in the entire catalog. But thank you for sharing that. It's one that I'm proud of.
Yeah, it's one of those interesting situations where a lot of times you'll come back to me and the songs that you didn't actually play on end up being your favorites. And I will tell you that that's one of my favorites.
Yeah, and I mean, I will touch on one thing that you just said, because most of the songs that I'm not on are my favorites. And it's weird, like I'll tell you.
Why is that?
I've thought about this. And I mean, so I'll tell you, in Veteran Avenue, Dead Hour is probably my favorite track that you've done.
Todd and Brian Rumbly, Todd Boyle, Brian Rumbly.
Yeah, very talented guys. But it's like, it's almost like I can finally hear what you're doing and what the band is doing without thinking of what I was doing. And okay. I know that sounds a little self-centered, but it's hard not to hear yourself in the project, because most musicians, we scrutinize everything we do. And if there was a snare out of place or a cymbal out of place, that's what I hear in the songs. And I can't unhear it once I know it's there. So to be able to listen to it from a different lens, I appreciate it more, and then it inspires me to go back and want to do new things.
Well, we hope you'll stick around. The song The Haunted Save Your Life will be at the end of this episode, and we're going to take a quick break, and after the break, we're going to come back and turn the tables. The Mog would like to congratulate Rev Records for their new location at 4 North Main Street, across from Buon Tempo Brothers and around the corner from John's Men's Clothing. Swing by for all things vinyl and to see their expanded inventory and space. While in town, don't forget to download the Park mobile app for a convenient, change-free parking experience. Coming up on July 17th, Transcendent Events will be hosting StellarCon at the APG FCU Arena at Harford Community College. This will be a first-of-its-kind Comic-Con in Harford County. Tickets are $15 for adults and half price for kids under 12. Just go to tickets.harford.edu. Vendor spots are still available. If you're interested, contact transcendentevents@gmail.com. Also, on July 23rd and 24th at the Bear Legacy Adventure Trails is the Bear Legacy Bluegrass Festival, presented by the Maryland Center for the Performing Arts. For more details or tickets, visit www.mdcenterforthearts.org/bear-legacy-bluegrass-festival. All right, welcome back to the Mog. I'm sitting here with Gary Holmes, and Gary Holmes is now going to turn the tables on me, Brad Cox, and he's going to give me something to chew on. So go ahead, Gary.
Well, Brad, thank you for letting me do this.
Absolutely.
When you told me that you were doing a podcast, about a month and a half ago, you had just started it?
Yeah, June 6th.
I got a sneak preview, and I was like, man, I really want to find a way to get on there. And I didn't think I was going to be able to come on and do anything except maybe talk about what we just did, dad jokes and things like that. But I thought to myself, I've known Brad a long time. And while I know a lot about the guy, there's a lot of things that I want to know more about.
Okay.
And I think the audience of you would want to know more about. So we'll start simple, right?
Okay.
So you have 20 plus years of catalog.
Yeah.
It's a tremendous catalog, not only in songwriting and recording albums, but now in writing books and all these different medium. What is the thing that drives you to continually put out content? Because the thing that I find interesting is that you've done it so consistently. There's been no downtime at all. And there's got to be something that drives you to just constantly put out new content.
Yeah, probably the main driving force is that I get very depressed when I'm not creating. So there have been moments where I wasn't creating as much, and it kind of I start kind of slipping into a dark place. So to kind of stay out of that place mentally, I like to write. Probably the original catalyst would be, I think that there was always this sense, probably due to abandonment issues or whatever you want to call it, where I didn't feel like anything I ever did was good enough. So I had to keep trying to find ways to get better and better and better. So I may hit a certain level, but I've already accepted that's not good enough. So then I try to take it higher and higher. Eventually you do kind of hit a ceiling, but I think that that's one of the motivating factors.
So with all the projects you've done, right?
Yep.
I'm going to try to list them. Nowhere's Child. Was that the first one?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I probably edit that right out, but yeah.
Now that was a long time ago, man. You were a kid then.
I was probably 15, 16 years old when I did that.
And now it's Nowhere's to be Found, right?
Nowhere's to be Found. See, there's the comedian.
Then obviously we know Schizo Calypso for many, many years. Then you did Nikki Thunders.
Yeah.
Which was, I think, your first departure doing a solo project.
Mm-hmm.
And then that morphed into eventually We Love the Underground, which then became a full band. And now you're doing Veteran Avenue. Did I miss any of them?
I don't think so. Well, did you say Nobody Likes Neville?
Well, okay, you were in that. I was thinking of projects that were primarily led by you, right?
No, I think that's it.
So the question I have is, when you write a song, and obviously these things occurred at different periods of your life, but do you know that this song is going to be good for this project, or do you just write and then you just put it to the project?
I tend to just write and then put it to the project. There's been songs that I wrote that I knew, like, this is more Schizo Calypso than We Love the Underground. But some of the projects didn't exist yet, so how would you know? So, like, Nikki Thunders was a really cool project for me because it was a turning point. It's when I realized that this is my voice. I found my voice. It was actually the song Vampires of Hollywood when I realized that's my voice. And so I started kind of like, I wanted to play with that. I wanted to kind of find out what that voice sounded like in the context of different music. So I created that project. And then I went from there to try to figure out, like, how can I apply that to more rock and roll music, like We Love the Underground. So I always say that, like, you know, We Love the Underground is the amalgamation of Nikki Thunders and Schizo Calypso. So when you start having these entities like Nikki Thunders, Schizo Calypso, We Love the Underground, then you can write a song and be like, okay, well, that's a Nikki song all day long, or that's a We Love the Underground song. So,
yeah, and it was really cool watching that evolution. For me, I think the Nikki Thunders stuff was really one of the, it introduced like this kind of dancey element, a lot of four on the floor.
Yeah.
And to me, that was like when some real personality started to shape around you as an artist and not necessarily the band,
yeah,
right? Which was kind of cool. And you've evolved since then over that. Now with Veteran Avenue, it's very evident that you know, like, where you're going with songwriting and what you're trying to accomplish and how you're trying to say those things. So with all of that catalog, and we talked to you when you were interviewing me, we talked a little bit about this. You get to go back and have all of these things to tape in various phases of your life,
mm-hmm,
from almost adolescence through becoming a father and becoming all of the things that go on in life to this point. Are there any moments when you listen to songs that are actually difficult to listen to and you think to yourself, wow, it really takes me to a place and it's hard for me to digest that still?
I think that the impact for me of Join the Cult and a lot of the material on that, I'm not really over that. I think songs like Behind the Smile, even Tug of War, like these things where I was dealing with these emotional and even mental issues at that time that were completely fresh for a 17, 18-year-old kid, it's hard for me to go back and listen to it.
Yeah.
Like if I hear a song that I wrote that's, you know, really dark, you know, whatever, suicidal, it's like I almost don't even want to hear it anymore. You know, but then there's songs on that record like Shooting Down on America that really take me back to like skateboarding around the neighborhood. It's got that punk attitude. And I really can't wait to hear those songs still. I still love those songs. So,
and to tag on to what you had said, and I think it was with Edgar, the interview you did with him, where you mentioned something that really stuck with me. You talked about when you write a song, you put it out into the world, that you have to live with what you said.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for all of the years that I played in Schizo and we wrote, when you wrote songs, but I was a part of it, that never hit me because I never had that level of attachment of like, that was my word, that was my thought, that was my emotion. Are there any songs that do that for you where you go, you have to live with that and own that and say, wow, I said those things and I've had to reconcile that in some manner in my mind.
Yeah, it's really the first couple albums, honestly. I became a little bit more conscious of what I was doing and that affect when I started getting into the later records. Probably after The Shattering, I was like, okay, so I started realizing the impact that a record like The Shattering had on so many people, and I was like, okay, well, I'm kind of more responsible for what I'm saying now, right? So, you know, if I wanted to communicate something, I might veil it a little bit more. You guys might even be like, what is he talking about? But, and there was a reason for that, you know? I knew what it was about. So, more so on the front end.
Yeah. So, let's talk about the total journey here, right?
Yeah.
So, there's been a lot of a lot of great moments
yeah.
in Schizo, a lot of things that went on. But I think we all, and I know I have mine, there are those defining moments where you are either at a show or you hear an album or you listen to a song that's done by really one of your peers, not an influence like we know you love Guns N' Roses and the
sure.
influences that got you into the stage.
Yeah.
But are there defining moments for you that you heard or saw something you're like, wow, I want to up my game. I want to really changed and elevate myself to the next level.
There was two occasions like that. The first time was in 2003. Mark Hordeman, which was my stepfather at the time, he gave me a copy of Lennox for the Sake of Simplicity. And at the time, all local music sounded like local music. There really wasn't a bar, and whatever bar that there was, I wasn't really aware of it. And I heard that record, and I was like, oh my God, like this is a local band? Like it yeah. sounded as good as the national bands. That was like a forever changing moment. The second moment though was really funny. I was back in college at Towson and finishing up a semester, and I was driving to the beach, and we were in party mode, and we were going down to play Kegs and Eggs at was it Cowboys? What was the name of that club?
It's funny, and it's Coyotes. And I'll stop you for just a second,
okay.
and I'll let you finish the story. This is also a defining moment for me.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
So your brother and I, we stayed up all night. We drank our faces off because a lot of the Coyotes gigs were just kind of, it was like band practice. There wasn't a lot of people there. It didn't matter if we were good or bad.
Yeah.
And especially at like 9, 10 o'clock in the morning. So we didn't care. We didn't care if we got up there and were terrible. So we pull into the parking lot, and the first thing that caught my eye was the trailer attached to the truck, and it was Hailstorm. And we got up there and slopped through our set, you know, and it was live, it was on the air, but we slopped through it, and again, who cares? Who's even listening? And then she gets up there, and for one, she's just destroying it. Her voice is incredible, the band is tight. But at one point, she did a Led Zeppelin song, and I think it was Black Dog. And she was staring at me, like, intently, just right into my eyes, staring at me while she sang this. And it was amazing, her performance, but I was just like, holy shit. Like, I knew in that moment, not only was she going to make it, but I've got to up my game. Yeah. I can't come out here looking a fool. And then what we did was, you know, kind of what we always did if we had a bad show. We went back to the hotel and just drank it away. It didn't happen.
Yes.
But then the next morning, you know, because, you know, social media wasn't really there to remind us, and driving home, and it was just like kind of a bittersweet feeling. Like, well, we just saw this amazing band, but on the flip side, God damn, they're good, and we're not. So we, you know, at that point, we really had to get our act together.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, it's so funny because when I thought of this question, I was like, I wonder if he's going to say it. And if he doesn't tell the story, I'll tell it.
Yeah.
But I think the very first song that she played, didn't she start a cappella? It was like,
yeah, I'm in love with somebody or it's not you.
And I just remember being in the room. We had finished playing. I think we'd packed up. We were kind of back at the merch table or something.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a lot of people in the room. It was like the bartender, Skip Dixon. God love Skip Dixon. Wonderful Ocean City
yeah.
guy, DJ, did so much for that local scene. So people weren't really paying attention, and when she got up there and started singing, you kind of saw people looking, and then it just, like, the whole crowd was captivated in this bar, which we didn't think anything was going to happen.
Yeah.
And that head-turning factor, as we watched them grow over the next 5, 7, 8 years, she did that at every show they ever played. They came to Baltimore, they did that. And that was that it factor, man. And you were right. It's like you look at that and you go, okay, no matter what I want to believe about what I do, until I can do that, right, and what they're doing, I'm not where I need to be.
Well, I think also for us at the time, the focus really wasn't on making it. I don't think that we thought that it was really realistic at that time. And she obviously proved all of us wrong there. But once we realized, okay, this is where the bar is, we started going for it. And then all of a sudden, some of these peers of ours would start saying to us, like, what are you guys practicing? You guys sound great. It's like, no, no, we're just, no, Bruce from Lennox. We're just not drinking before we go on stage. Like, because for us, it was like showtime was like bowling night for us. Who said that recently? John Amarillo. But anyway, it was like, we were just like, we're going out, we're going to drink beers, we're going to play loud music, and we're going to go home. And then all of a sudden it was like, we're going to go up there, we're going to slay the stage, and we're going to get off and be proud of ourselves, and then we're going to drink our beers.
Right. And I think that when you start, you know, it points out that where you may lack in talent or songwriting ability, or you make up or you compensate for by being loud, aggressive in your face. And I mean, it worked for a period of time.
If you can't be good, be loud.
Right. and we were. But all those things really elevated to the next level, which was very cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it was great.
So I've got a couple of things here. I don't know how much of this I'll get through. So I put my hot takes about Brad on here.
Oh, God.
And some of this we've kind of already covered, in, at least even when you were interviewing me. And I think the one that I wrote down was, speak it, do it, no regrets. Mm-hmm. To me, that was one of the things that you always did. And it's like, and I knew it would be coming. Like, Brad would say, hey, I'm thinking about doing this thing. And I knew you weren't thinking about it. That was your way of saying, prepare yourself. This is where we're headed.
Yeah.
Whether it was into the studio or going to go do a show or whatever. And, as I mentioned before, that's also what I've learned to appreciate about you, because that really is what drove the band.
Yeah.
And you didn't have any fear about it. So I appreciated that.
Yeah. I could have stood to have a little bit more fear, I guess, at times, but
I also wrote down Doctor of Chicken Wings and Things. This is just a fascinating thing about you. The chicken wing diet and the black coffee. And
well, we were always trying to find ways to not, to kind of offset the drinking. So it was either running marathon races after like a keg party, or it was like taking the Atkins diet to a new level.
Right.
It's like, okay, well, I'm only going to eat meat. I'm going to eat greasy fried meat that is not going to stick with me with black coffee. And truth be told, during 2003 to 2005, I think it was, that diet was like, that was like my crash diet. I would do that, and then I would get up on stage, and I would look good. I could take my shirt off proudly, but I felt terrible.
Yeah, and it's funny, because you've always, you were always into making sure you took care of yourself. For many years, it was just to make sure you look good.
Right.
And nowadays, you still take care of yourself, but you have a doctor helping along right. the way at times.
Right. Got Losartan.
Right. The novels.
Yeah.
You've written 3 books.
Yes.
Which is an incredible feat. Like, I mean, writing a song is one thing, and I've written songs. I don't really do it very often, but if you can play the guitar or even talk to some degree, you could probably write a song. But to actually write an entire book is not something that anybody can just say they did.
Yeah.
That is an incredible feat. And you've done it 3 times. And I remember when you were writing the books, you know, you would tell me, like, I got through another so many thousand words. What was it like to go through the experience the first time and then to do it again and again? And did you know you were going to do all 3 of them right from the get-go? And what drove you through the exhaustion to continue writing even though you'd never done it before?
So I realized I was going to do 3 books pretty much halfway through the first book. And my feeling was basically, in the beginning anyway, was if I can even string together enough words to justify a book, I will be happy. I don't care if it's the worst thing I've ever done. I've strung together what I see as a book length of words, and I'm good. But then obviously, as you get into it, you're like, no, I want this to be good. You know. But I still look at my first book the way I look at Join the Cult. Like, it's very special to me, but it's kind of like a virgin effort. You know. But then I read the third book, And that one kicks ass. I mean, that one's great, but you can't get, you know, to there without going there. So,
and man, it's amazing. And it's funny because, you know, and you know this, I haven't read any of these books.
Yeah.
And it's not because I don't care. It's just that I don't really read.
Yeah. Well,
and, the funny story is when we went to Las Vegas, and was it 2016 is when you started writing the book?
No, actually the first book was out by then. It came out in 2015, September of 2015.
Oh, was it the second book you were on?
Yeah.
So I just remember, to me, I'm a huge fan of Seinfeld.
Mm-hmm.
People may or may not know that. But there's a great scene in Seinfeld where David Putty, who is Elaine's boyfriend, they get on a plane.
Okay.
And she starts reading, and man, he's just staring at the back of the seat in front of him. And she's like, you're not going to read, you're not going to do anything. He's just like, no. And that is how I felt being on the plane next to you, because you pulled out that laptop and I'm like, what is he doing? And you just start writing. And there I am, just like stared at the seat. I don't even like reading. I'm just looking at the people in front of me. And I'm like, I feel like so low right now. This guy's writing a book and I'm not even afraid to read one.
Well, you know, actually that chapter that I wrote is in the second book. I think it's the first chapter or the third chapter, but it's in there. Yeah,
I remember that. We had a discussion. I don't remember what the discussion was, but we talked about that.
If anything, I would encourage you, I'll give you a copy of the second book. Read the, I believe it's the preface. Read that part, because that's what I wrote on the plane.
Okay.
And it's very amusing, actually.
Yeah.
Because the pressure's off. You're writing a preface. It's when you start getting into the story and the book and the pacing and the characters and all that it gets a little bit complicated.
So with that, I turn to the podcast here, which, by the way, I love.
Thank you.
And I've tried all my life to
I lost control of it.
That's a good thing.
Yeah. I'm actually at some point going to see if, like, you would be interested in doing, like, one Sunday a month. I will basically turn on the gear. I'll give you the guest name. You can do the research. I will go for a walk and go about my Sunday, and you can do it, and then I'll edit it later, and that'll be that.
Yeah, that would be great. We can absolutely do that. We'll see if I can get through this, right, and make it okay.
You're doing great.
But the thing that I love about the podcast is, one, I mean, it just sounds great. I'm enjoying listening to all the artists. But as knowing you and being a friend for so many years, I love the pay it forward part of this.
Yeah.
Like, this is such an appropriate thing for where you are in your life and your journey to be learning about new artists or even artists that have been around for a long time and creating a forum for them to promote themselves and to really be able to... I mean, it's the greatest way to interview somebody.
I want to talk about that. One of the things that I feel like I finally learned was the difference between community and competition. There's a lot of people, especially in the musical world, where whether you want it to be the case or not, you're in competition with one another, and on some level or not. And this is really not about that. This is about community. And because it's community-based, they're into it, you know, they want it to exist, because it's not just a platform for me to get on here and do these interviews. It's a platform for them to get their music out there. So everybody's happy with that, you know, and it doesn't bring out any like ugliness or any of that. So for me, it's that community is my focus. I really started getting into that during Five Stars, that whole love local mantra. And I really just shed the skin of competition. I don't care anymore what other people are doing.
And it is so evident. And, you know, I wrote here, too, your influence on the local music scene. Because a lot of people know you've been around for a very long time and you've done a lot. And I think this is going to leave a really great lasting impression. And it's funny that you said competition, because that was the mentality that we had when we first started with Schizo
Calypso.
We
referred to ourselves as Unicron.
Brad, I wore the shirt for a reason. If you can't see what I'm wearing, I have a shirt on that has a picture of the Transformers 1986 cartoon movie, which we all love.
Yes,
it's one of our
yes.
favorite things. But I'll let you tell the story, if you remember it, of how Unicron really sort of defined a very small period of time when we didn't care about other bands, and how ignorant that was back then, and how much... That is something that I regret.
Well, it was an attitude. It was a mentality. It kind of ran not just through us, but also through our fans. And our fans were, I mean, I actually felt bad sometimes for the bands that played after us or before us, because our fans would go out there and give them hell. And they did it because they thought that that's what we would have wanted them to do. And we didn't. We'd be backstage like, oh my God, here they go. But anyway, it was, I think it was an article in the Penny Saver.
Yeah.
And we were asked, like, how do you see yourself in relation to the other bands in the area? I think I said something like, well, I think I see ourselves as Unicron, and they're like all the other planets, and we're just eating them up. You know, and that was kind of the analogy that I used in that moment.
It was. And I think back on that, and I'm like,
what an arrogant.
How ignorant. It's like, we're out here, you know, trying to, what are we doing? Right. You know, we just referred to ourselves as a cartoon planet that eats other planets.
Yeah. But the inevitable demise of that planet. So
it was, you know,
and we got our act together, you know, we started to fly right around 2005.
Fun fact about that movie, and I didn't realize this because now I'm showing it to my children. Do you know what year it takes place in?
No.
So the movie was in 1986.
But I feel like if you're bringing it up, it's probably like 2021 or something.
It was the year 2005.
Oh my God.
That was the year. It was.
How ambitious.
Taking place in 2005. So we haven't gotten there yet.
Yeah.
These movies never seem to be able to predict where things are going to be, but that's just a fun fact. So, I was going to do let's do a fun segment.
Yeah, let's do a fun segment.
So, stage moments. We all have them, right?
Yes.
Do you have a most embarrassing moment?
There's a couple. One was something that nobody else saw. At one point, we watched on a replay video, but the lights cut. And as the lights cut, Ryan Booth brought his bass guitar down, slapped me on the head, like, you know, with brute force, and I fell to the ground like a sack of potatoes. And it was in the moment, it was humiliating because I felt like everybody saw it. I don't think anybody saw it, you know.
I remember that because that was when we used to record all the shows, and we would always watch them the next day at your house.
Yeah.
And I remember we would just rewound that part like 1,000 times.
Right.
What about your most nerve-wracking moment?
I was most nervous for Power Man 5000. Power Man 5000 was very nerve-wracking because the weekend prior, we lost our bass player, we lost our keyboard player, and for that particular show, we had to have two bass players and two keyboard players come out so we could still do the show. So we had, you know, a bass player learn four songs, and the other bass player learn the other four songs, and same with the keyboard players. But when we got through that, even though it was completely nerve-wracking, because we looked like a clown car of a band, I was like, we can get through anything. And so it was nerve-wracking, probably the most nerve-wracking, but also very rewarding, because from there, it was like the snowball started rolling. It was Power Man 5000, LA Guns, Skid Row, Seven Mary 3, Local Age, Brides of Destruction. Like, it didn't stop. And the only reason it stopped is because we stopped selling tickets. You know?
Yeah. No, yeah, it was a great, great run.
Yeah.
So maybe you just described this, but I was going to say the most triumphant moment.
Probably the most triumphant moment on stage is Stabbing Westward with We Love the Underground. That was a show that we as a band, as We Love the Underground, you could kind of feel like things were starting to fall apart for whatever the reason. I think we're all kind of getting on different pages a little bit. But we got up there and we slayed it. And every single person I ran into made a point to stop and say, that was a kick-ass show. And because of that, I was like, it was almost like we've arrived.
You know?
And that was probably my favorite show.
Yeah, I agree. And I think there's a couple, because I obviously had a chance to think about these, right?
Now you have.
So for me, a triumphant moment, which is also a great story. Do you remember when we opened up for Michael Graves down in D.C.?
Yes, I do.
And that audience wanted nothing to do with
us. No, well, it's punk rock.
It was a punk rock show. We were opening, and I have never been so intimidated by a stone-cold audience in my life. We handed out CDs before the show.
Yeah.
And they
smashed them.
They were smashing them in the crowd while we were playing.
Yeah.
And
they wanted nothing to do with it. Because at that point, we were turning the corner. We weren't even like a punk rock and roll band at that point. We were kind of like leaning towards hard rock. And we were just out of our element at that point.
I remember we identified early on that we cannot leave any dead space in between these songs because right. it would just be awkward. From the time we played the last note, Brian and I got, we had our stuff packed up, and I think we were on 495 within about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
It was the quickest loadout. Like, we have to get out of here. We don't belong. They don't want us here. And
right.
on to the next one.
Yeah. Right?
So maybe you already described it, but do you have a most memorable moment?
The very first time we played Ram's Head live sticks out in my mind because that was the first time we played a venue of that size.
Yeah.
And that was like 2002 or three. I don't know what it was, but I remember being so excited about it. And Matt Davis actually had nothing to do with that particular show, but I wanted to share the news with Matt Davis. I was like, Matt Davis, we made it. We're playing Ram's Head live. And it was just such a huge thing. But I think the most defining was when we became the band of the month.
Yeah.
I don't know if we were the first one, but we were definitely the band of the month very early on in that whole series that Matt Davis was doing. And I remember just seeing it in the papers. We became the Pabst Blue Ribbon Band of the Month as a result. I think that was the catalyst for that article. And I remember it was around Christmas time. It was actually Christmas Eve or the day before. It was that weekend when it was announced. And I was on such a cloud nine that you knew I drank a lot. I drank more than a lot those 2 days, two or 3 days. It was like the old Joe Ruggiero, like, you can just go ahead and kill yourself now, because I felt like I made it, you know?
And I agree, man. And, you know, it's funny because when you sit here and talk about all of the crazy partying and that went on, one of the things that I'm most proud of you for over the years is that a lot of that partying was about creating a rock and roll feel.
Mm-hmm.
It was about creating a vibe around hanging out and just, it was all there, I think, really to help push the brand and push the image. And you have totally been able to shed that over the years, man. I told you this the other night. I love it. You know, now that's not you anymore. I mean, you can have a good time when you want to, but it doesn't define you in any way. And now you've talked about it before. You're a year out, right? Almost from.
Yeah, it's been a year since I've drank as of July 15th.
And that is remarkable, man. Yeah. And you should be proud of that. And it just goes to show how much self-control and dedication you have to your craft. Because I know you've told me, like, look, I just, in order for me to keep going and keep doing things, I want to be as clear and as crisp as possible in all facets of my life. And that's why I think, you know, where you're headed, whether it's in songwriting or podcasting or writing books, you're just going to continue to up your game. And that's an impressive thing to be able to do.
I think with the drinking, especially on the early end of this, was that it was about creating that atmosphere of socialization.
Yep.
And that was something that everybody was comfortable doing. And although I would look back and regret being as drunk as we were getting on stage a lot of times, because we have to like live with that and those videos exist, I wouldn't really change it, I don't think. So.
Yeah, you definitely learned something through all of that craziness.
Because people didn't care if we were good, bad, or whatever. They were there because people get behind something they believe in. And they believed in what we were doing. We believed in what we were doing. And they figured they'll get there. Will over skill, they'll get there. So.
Yep. All right, so little last segment here.
Yep.
And you may or may not have good answers to these, right? These are questions that I don't know if any songwriter will really be able to answer easily, but I'll ask them to you anyway. Do you have a song that you're most proud of?
A song that I'm most proud of. I don't know why, but it's, I don't know that I'm most proud of it, but from Schizo Calypso, it's still The Gift.
That's a good one.
For me, it really captured kind of a dark period, again, of just kind of being like, you've done all these things, you've written all these songs, and you feel just kind of empty from the whole thing, even though it was wonderful. But it's kind of like, well, now what? And something about that song always kind of gives me chills. So from Underground, it would be The Isolationist. I went through a really, really terrible phase prior to Patch.com, where my OCD issues were really, really overblown. And I got through it. And Come Destroyer was all about that. And on the other side of Come Destroyer was The Isolationist. And it's this really beautiful song about kind of accepting your place kind of in isolation. Like, the band's gone, everybody's gone, but being okay with that. And then trying to think if there was one. Right now for Veteran Avenue, it's probably... It may be actually an unreleased song, the one I sent you the other day, but Cross and Crown's up there, Dead Hour's up there, so...
And, you know, you kind of brought it up, and I had a question here, but I didn't really know whether I wanted to ask it or not, but you talked about the OCD a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been very... One of the things I love about you is you're an open book about who you are as a person, and I think people feel that, and I think as an artist, that's incredibly important, and I think that's why a lot of people... At least, and I can feel it as people come onto this show and talk to you about their own artistry, that being that open book is huge. How has OCD, because you've talked to me before about the ideas and the thoughts, and it's like you want to get that stuff out of your head sometimes and put it on paper. Has songwriting been a humongous therapy for you over the years in managing that?
Yeah, in the very beginning of this segment, you asked what the catalyst was, and I got into like abandonment issues. I got into never feeling like I was good enough. But also, it's getting those thoughts out. It's the art therapy that keeps me kind of going. It's like I've got to express these things. Lisa's wonderful. She's an awesome soundboard, and that helps get it out a little bit. At least I can talk to somebody.
Yeah.
But music, I can kind of indirectly talk to everybody and myself. So... OCD has been something I've struggled with since I ran off to Hollywood. It kind of waxes and wanes. Sometimes it's really, really bad, and I can't really describe to you what it is, but music always seems to come through.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I think it's a very, not only therapeutic way for you to deal with that, but it also produces great results.
Yeah.
And I mean, that whole feeling of if I slow down, I'll stop, to me, is like where I love and see that coming. You just keep on going, man.
You know what's funny about that song? The first verse starts with 17 in indecision, and then it's 27. I guess there has to be a 37-47 now, because I'm closer to 47 now.
It's wild, man.
I mean, I'm not 47, but I'm closer to that than I am 37, so...
It's amazing. And, you know, you mentioned Lisa, and I can say, like, what an amazing support she has been for not only for you, but the band. I mean, such a positive person and just there to completely be supportive of all of that art. And that is tremendous to have in your corner, man, for not only all these years, but for the rest of your life.
Yeah, man.
So you are very passionate about everything. I mean, all of this that you've put together, you are in the middle of a trademark dispute, right? Which is almost over.
Hopefully, yeah.
And we don't have to get into it too much, but I remember when this first started.
November of 2017.
And you told me that it was happening, and the music was, some of it was being taken offline and all these forms. And at the time, you were like, you obviously didn't know what this was going to entail and how much you were going to have to put into this. But I knew from the beginning, I was like, there is no way that this is going to stop him, and whoever is on the other end of this is going to pay dearly, because this is his life they're messing with, and he's going to be an absolute pit bull. And you have been, and I hope that every bit of what you've done is yours forever, and that you get past this, because I know it has been a lot on you, but you've done an awesome job navigating it.
Do you remember the Big Lebowski?
Do I remember it?
I mean, it's really that...
You're out of your element, Brad.
Yeah. This aggression won't stand, man. Yeah. And that's what it is. It's just like, it's not even about the band name. It's like, I'll find a way to get the music out there, but it's like, it's not just me. There was other bands that this guy affected, and it's just, it's the BS end of it that I wasn't going to put up with. So, yeah, that's why I went after him the way I did, and hopefully it's almost over, but yeah, I wasn't going to put up with that.
Yeah. I remember... telling my father-in-law about it. We had gone to Independent. We had a few beers. Yeah. We were hanging out. And I remember we were texting back and forth, and I was just telling him, I was like, Brad is a total pit bull on this, man, and he is not gonna back down. There's just no way. So kudos to you.
Well,
is there a song audiences love but you don't?
Yeah, you know what? I never really liked the song Black Fly. I don't like it. I know you guys would probably have agreed with me. But they did, and
they
never
loved it.
Yeah, and I never understood why. I don't like that song. I can't say I don't like it. I like the version that was on Electrophoria that was kind of dancey and whatever. And the idea, but yeah, I don't like that song. I know Nick Ellison, if he listens to this, he's going to be like, what?
He will be crushed, but be crushed. It's okay. We did it. We played it plenty of times. So that's...
Yeah.
Do you think you've already written your legacy song, or is it still to come?
I don't know, man. I feel like there's been times where I'm kind of happy with where I'm at. And then, like, you get the itch. A couple months go by, and you're like, no, I'm not done yet. I know I'm not done yet. I don't think that I'll ever really be done.
No.
Right now, my focus is the podcast. So maybe musically, I won't be doing that as much, but...
Well, listen, man, I'll let you end this, but I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to do this interview.
And, you end it.
Well, Brad, here on the Mog, this was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And hopefully we'll get to do this again at some other capacity.
Yeah, so you were the first to be on Turn the Tables, and we appreciate you being on the show. Like I said, listen for the Haunted Save Your Life.
And in the words of Michael Scott, my, how the turntables have turned.
There you go. Peace.
Save your life. I died. My father tried. Can't.